Okay, this is talking with George Seelstad at Green Bank on 22nd May, 1985.
Well, could you tell me where you went as an undergraduate, what you studied, and then how it was you came to Caltech, and how you came in contact with radio astronomy first?
Okay, I was an undergraduate at Dartmouth College, majored in physics, went to grad school at Caltech, got my degree from Dartmouth in 1959, and went as a physics graduate student to Caltech. I chose Caltech partly because of the excellence of its astronomy, but when I went there, I had no idea they did radio astronomy. As a matter of fact, I didn't know what radio astronomy was.
You had not been a radio ham or anything like that?
No, I didn't have that kind of background either. The graduate program at Caltech had a lot of coursework for about 2 years, but in that time you were supposed to find someone to work with on a thesis. And early in 1960, I had a chance to go to the Owens Valley. Well, it was very funny. A chemistry professor on leave from Dartmouth was spending a year at Caltech. Mm-hmm. He had heard about the radio observatory, wanted to drive up and see it, wanted to know if I wanted to go, and I did with another chemist. And John Bolton was there. We stayed overnight. He put us to work in his characteristic style. Mm-hmm. I mean, he welcomed us, took care of us, showed us everything, and then said, you know, but you should, and then let us stay all night, but now you should do something for us. And we dug holes for trees, for planting trees, and the guy was amazing. Anyway, Bolton, as far as an individual having an influence, it was John Bolton. He was really dynamic, and the heart of that program, he lifted it off the ground alone, I think. And deserves a big place in the history of radio astronomy. Mm-hmm. He was really a dynamo. And I was very attracted to his group and talked to him, would I like to, could I get into it? And they were dying to get people in. He took everybody he could get his hands on. And mm-hmm. it was I consider I arrived at the perfect time at the perfect place because the field was still so young and so many things were about to happen at Caltech. And it was a little bit like Frank explained yesterday, you made a discovery. I mean, you know, you did something with the telescope. It was a discovery because so little was known.
Frank Drake referring to the early days of Green Bank.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, why do you say it was the perfect time? What was actually at Owens Valley? What was going to
well,
happen?
Well, this was early 1960. They finished one of their 90-foot dishes at the end of 1959 and the second one at the end of 1960. Or early in 1960. So I was there just as the interferometer was mm-hmm. getting started. And interferometry was even, Frank talked yesterday about an 85-foot dish here. Well, at least there'd been some research in that. And interferometry wasn't a new technique, but it was still, it was newer than, say, having a single 85-foot dish. Yeah. There was a lot of work to do. And there it was. And they needed manpower to get involved.
And so you started working out there as a research assistantship or something like that?
Yes, I got into the Bolton, into the group, the radio astronomy group. I spent summer there, but I still had a lot of classwork. But during every break and vacations, you would go up to the Owens Valley. And while you were in Pasadena, John would ask you to make power supplies or, you know, in some way you were still involved in what mm-hmm. was going on and still helping him a lot. And the group was John Bolton and Gordon Stanley mostly handling the electronics. And then Jim Roberts came occasionally. Rad came later. There were really very few people mm-hmm. involved. And the few who were there sort of worked around the clock to make things go.
And then three or four students beside yourself.
And then he picked up students. Ken Kellerman and, well, before the initial graduate student in radio astronomy at Caltech was Dan Harris. Mm-hmm. Following him, Dick Reed, Bob Wilson, and Al Moffat all came in before me. And then my year was Barry Clark, Ken Kellerman, and Fritz Bartlett, who ended up in computer programming and high energy physics. And then we were followed by others, Glenn Berg and Ed Fomalhaut.
So it sounds like you just learned radio astronomy by doing it there.
Yes.
There were no formal courses?
No, they did then have a course. They had a one-semester course, and Martin Schmidt taught it. And But Martin had, although we think of him as an optical astronomer, had done 21-centimeter work at Leiden, and he he tried to keep in touch. So there was a course. But see, the nice thing was you could, in those days, if you entered radio astronomy then, someone say, well, why don't you read the literature? You could read it all. You could read every radio astronomy paper. Mm-hmm. You only had to go back. Well, if you went back to Jansky, okay, yeah. 18 years. But then there were, for, you know, it was a handful of papers.
And so, in fact, was that the typical thing that...
You would sit down and think, well, I'm going to learn something about radio astronomy, and you'd start reading the papers, and, you know, after a few weeks, you'd realize there were no others to read.
So, what about the other optical astronomers? You mentioned Martin Schmidt. Do you feel that they had an influence in what was going on there from your point of view as a graduate student?
No.
It was really just Bolton and Stanley and...
Yeah, no, I think it was a very strange story. I think the radio astronomy group at Caltech started because I think the vision of the Office of Naval Research, which felt radio astronomy, we want to get some radio astronomy going in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And Lee DuBridge, who was president of Caltech, and Bob Bakker was the chairman of that division of physics, mathematics, and astronomy. And they wanted to start radio astronomy. The radio astronomy group, it was my impression, was treated by the optical astronomy establishment as sort of second-class citizens. None of those people had faculty appointments. In fact, it was probably late in the 1960s before they appointed a radio astronomer to the tenure stream faculty, and that was Al Moffat.
That's interesting.
The rest of the people were research fellows or senior research fellows, and there, I think there was always a feeling in the optical astronomy group that radio astronomy was it was like ham radio or something. I mean,
they were willing to say it had exciting results, apparently, but that the people...
Well, I think that was
right
funny.
Or?
Yeah, they certainly didn't have the right pedigree. They were, I don't even think, well, Bolton may have had a PhD. I'm not sure about that. He may not have. And they were a different, they were not as gentlemanly as the old line optical astronomer with Palomar Observatory. And now John mingled well with people. John Bolton did, and I think commanded a lot of respect. But it was rather a separate enterprise. The optical identification work was mainly Tom Matthews and Alan Sandage, I guess, and maybe some others. Tom Matthews got more involved with the optical astronomers than anybody. That was kind of an individual basis. That wasn't as much.
There was just one grad student that sort of had a link.
He was a research fellow at that time.
Oh,
Tom had his PhD.
Oh, that's right.
From Harvard.
That's right. You're
and
right.
He
yeah.
got into the optical identification business, and then they started. You know, he'd feed positions to the optical astronomers, and they'd do identifications. But I wasn't. No, I don't think they.
Well,
I think it was a bit unfortunate. I don't.
Well, this is interesting because one person you haven't mentioned is Jesse Greenstein, who I always think is being another key person besides DuBridge and Bakker. And then, of course, Bada Minkowski made important contributions in the 50s.
Yeah, that's true. Now that connection between Bolton and Bada and Minkowski had been, well, I think John wrote them a letter from the Southern Hemisphere asking about various radio sources, way back, before he came at Caltech. And John may have moved with those people, but even not only were there no real tenured positions in radio astronomy, but the Caltech had put a lot of private money into Palomar and into the astronomy operation in general, but it was a long time. It was into the 70s, probably, or 80s, maybe, before... a sort of equivalent amount of private resources were put into the radio observatory.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was a long
that
time.
Was just all
it was all you got your own money. You know, you got a grant or something and did research with it. And that difference persisted for a very long time at Caltech. So,
well, that's very interesting. So, well, let's switch to the science that you were doing. What was seen to be the important problem to do with this interferometer or set of problems?
The main things were position measurements fast, and then that got them into the optical identification business. Then that Moffat and Maltby research. Then John's idea of the interferometer was, I don't know if he was thinking mapping, but he was certainly the structure of radio sources, angular sizes.
Visibility curve.
Like, visibility curves and that kind of analysis. And so that was regarded as big. I worked, when Rad came, he was very interested in polarization. There had been, at that time, it was still, I guess we thought synchrotron radiation was the mechanism, but polarization still hadn't been discovered. And it was quickly, but Rad had clever ideas about how to use an interferometer and cross dipoles and the coherence between them to measure polarization. And he, Dave Morris, and I spent a lot of time developing that technique and then measuring the polarization of sources.
Yeah, this is extragalactic radio sources primarily?
Nearly all extragalactic, although we had the Crab Nebula in there. And then we tried to go from the stage of just, well, we did two things. We measured the polarization at several frequencies and got into the rotation measure business and the galactic magnetic field. And we also then tried mapping with, interference. Well, we call it interference polarimetry. But mm-hmm. then we also tried mapping the polarization distributions across some sources.
How the vector changed.
That's right, mm-hmm. yeah.
So. And that was basically your thesis, which came out in 63.
That's right. I got my PhD from Caltech, and that was in physics, actually, in 1963.
Was this polarimetry, was that part of Bolton's plan also, or was that pretty much all Rad coming in?
Well, I would probably Rad's influence. I mean, John had a vision about the interferometer and what he wanted to do, but I think the polarization idea probably was Rad's.
Well, now another question I'm interested in is, you have this variable spacing interferometer, and can you remind me again, did it start off just as an east-west?
No, it did. From the start, there was a T. It was almost more an L than a T.
Yeah.
There was a little stub, but yeah.
Okay. What was the reasoning for making it that way?
Well, I think they wanted two-dimensional structure and even positions. I guess nobody knew it was aperture synthesis at the time, but they had the idea of sampling the UV plane. And they did, actually. If you look at the Moffat-Maltby papers, they start off, I think Al maybe had to write his thesis, and he just had the east-west data then or something, but he added north-south things later on. And even some hour angle tracks. They measured mm-hmm. off at hour angles. I think they had the idea of we'll get the full two-dimensional UV coverage and invert and get two-dimensional structure. And they did a little of that. I know on Centaurus A, Maltby had a, it was very just fortunate, but they had a long track in hour, not long, but sort of an hour and a half either side because the source was at minus 42 degrees and that was the most you could follow it. But it just happened that the visibility curve had wild ups and downs, and they fit a detailed model of Centaurus A to that data. And also in one of Moffat's papers, there was a nice, that Hercules A was picked out with the two-dimensional structure, and he had measured at odd hour angles and with the north-south mm-hmm. spacings and east-west, and it was I think they were very much on the track of mm-hmm. full aperture synthesis.
Is it correct to say that the reason that it wasn't quite the same as what Ryle was doing at Cambridge in the same era is that they did it in terms of models of separate visibility cuts, and they never did a full Fourier transform? Let's see, how good was the phase information in all of this?
It was primitive, but there was phase data. There was... Al actually had enough phase that you could tell the brighter source was on the east or the west or that kind of thing. That was to be perfected, but there was phase information. Moffat certainly knew about Fourier transforms and played around with it, but you're right. The first approach was the models to the visibility curves.
And but something that hasn't explicitly been mentioned yet is you're operating now at very high frequencies compared
that's
to what
right.
Cambridge is using.
Yeah.
Things are much more difficult.
Yes, that's right. They started at 31 centimeters, 960 megahertz. And the funny thing is, in those days, that was regarded as a high frequency. Mm-hmm. And you hoped your dishes would work at 21 centimeters because of the hydrogen line. And people thought, wow, that's really short wavelengths.
Right, and right. So what was the push for the high frequency? Simply resolution?
Probably that, and whether that was Bolton's idea too, and I don't know why. I don't know if he had some strong feeling about sources or just thought this is unexplored and let's start there. I'm not sure of the answer to that.
Do you think that in hindsight it may have been a hindrance to fully developing an aftersynthesis there because the phase thing is so different?
No, I don't think so. No, because look at Moffat's paper. There's enough phase information there to help mm-hmm. with the source structure. I think it would have worked. Mm-hmm. And then right after Al, Fomalhaut started a similar thing at, I think, 2800 megahertz. And they were getting phase information mm-hmm. and everything. He was more into the... So, no, I think it would have... Yeah. They could have done the technique then, too.
Do you think that the ONR funding had anything to do with it? That the military would be much more interested in centimeter waves?
No, the military, the ONR, that deserves a lot of credit. They did not, it was not military at all. They, except in the sense, I guess, the big broad picture, the military thought, if we have a lot of very bright people and always continuous new ideas, it will help the security of the country. But they did not direct it. Caltech in any way about what they were supposed to do. And that point should be brought out in history because you wonder if we're doing the right thing now. I can remember not John Bolton but Gordon Stanley showing me the proposals, what we'd now call a proposal, mm-hmm. and it basically you wrote a one-page letter to Shostak at ONR saying, well, we'd like to continue our research in radio astronomy. You might say we're going to put 21 centimeter receivers on the interferometer this year and we're going to do planetary studies and extragalactic and the galactic. And the thing was one page and we'll need $250,000 or something like that. And you'd get it. And that year, there weren't reviews. And Shostak either gave it to you or he didn't give it to you. And they didn't meddle in any way. They just mm-hmm. funded. Their approach was pick bright people, and you try to size up these people. And if those people thought they had a good idea, you funded them, and they pursued it. And it really made something good happen there at Caltech. I mean, it worked in many instances, mm-hmm. but I know as far as the military trying to tell Caltech what they were interested in and what they hoped they'd do, it didn't happen at all.
Mm-hmm.
No connection.
So in essence, you're saying you spent very little time with the bureaucratic aspects of
that's right.
keeping your funding up,
reports that's right.
and proposals and so forth.
And there was a quarterly report, and it was a one-page letter, and that you would just jot down a few things you did, and mm-hmm. thanks for your support or something like that, and send it off. There, ONR had an office in Pasadena, and one Navy officer worked there, and he sort of kept track. But no, the minimum, almost zero of fundraising or reporting or selling your ideas to referees or whatever.
When did that era change?
Began changing. ONR. That was a long time. It was into the Vietnam War and this feeling, the Mansfield Amendment, the military shouldn't fund universities, that ONR funding just sort of dried up, and we got gradually, as it was going down, NSF started picking it up.
In the early 70s.
Yeah. And it's interesting, but I talked to Kurt Riegel just yesterday about, recalling Frank Drake's remarks that he said to Struve, I'd like to try this, and then Struve could go ahead. No referees, no proposals, no anything. And Kurt said, yes, but astronomers kind of, to some extent, users of telescopes brought this on themselves. It's not quite true the NSF imposed this on everybody. When you reach the stage that others want, there was only so much money and others wanted a part, you began to get into, what did you give the money to this guy for? Yeah. You know, I wanted to do this, and my idea's better. Right. And then you need to set up some mechanism to start judging and start choosing.
When there were only a couple dozen radio astronomers in the country,
yeah,
it was different.
Well, and radio astronomy, remember, started, it was strange the way it started in this country. It had already started worldwide, and it was sort of, and in this case, maybe even bureaucrats thought, why isn't the U.S. involved in radio astronomy? Let's see if we can start some centers, and mm-hmm. we'll give them the money to do it. So it was the opposite of today, where you're sort of trying to promote your cause and get money. Someone was trying to dump it on you. So it was a different scene altogether.
Are there any points about the scientific results that we haven't discussed? I mean, what do you see as the main contribution that came out of that work in polarimetry, I guess, primarily?
Well, the fact that many radio extragalactic radio sources were linearly polarized, even though it was just a few percent, did sort of nail down the synchrotron theory. Since then, everyone believes the primary radiation mechanism is synchrotron radiation. Also, it was a nice study of the galactic magnetic field, the Faraday rotation through the galaxy. There was such a nice dependence of rotation measure on galactic coordinates that it was fairly convincing mm-hmm. that most of it took place in the galaxy. And even though people had talked about polarization of starlight, and that work had been done in the 50s, and there was a feeling there was a galactic magnetic field, this helped a lot, I think, to mm-hmm. establish the reality and the strength and the direction of the galaxy's magnetic field. We can't claim credit for that at Caltech. Gardner and White Oak in Australia had the first results and beat us. We were working at the same time, but they got there first. But the combination of the southern data and the northern right. made a kind of a nice picture. I think that work was valuable.
Was that part of the original plan in the program, or did that only develop after it became apparent that there was a lot of polarization you could measure, and therefore we could do this with it?
I think it developed later. I think we thought, let's see if we can find polarization in any sources.
Right.
And the funny thing was, we all picked, of course, the strongest sources in the sky, and that included Cygnus and others, and even in retrospect, those are very weakly polarized, so we just started with the wrong list. And once you went down one order, you know, the next order of magnitude, generally all those sources were polarized. So a little bit of bad luck. People beat their heads against a wall for a while trying to establish mm-hmm. the detection of polarization. And then it became widespread.
And I'm interested in your assessment of the status of synchrotron radiation. Of course, their polarimetry in the CRAB had been done at NRL.
Yes.
And optically had been done.
Yes.
M87, optically, the jet was known to be polarized.
Right.
But it was still thought that perhaps these were just peculiar instances.
That might
not still be synchrotron.
You couldn't find it in a lot of sources. No, I think the prejudice was that it was synchrotron radiation, or that was your feeling that it was. But then you thought, well, then these radio sources should show some polarization. And they weren't. I mean, it was very hard work to find it at first, and then boom, all of a sudden you could find it. And Burbidge had already written his theoretical papers, and it was the sort of, and Sklovsky, and it was the best idea around. But this helped. I mean, this added another element of support.
Mm-hmm. I realize this is before your era, but I'd be interested in your comments on why do you think there was this lag in development of radio astronomy in the U.S. compared to Britain and Australia and France?
That's a good question, Woody. I'm not sure I know.
Okay,
I don't know. And see,
that
to get it started, you brought in foreigners. You know, Caltech brought in Bolton, and NRL started it with sort of a home crew, and started before Caltech, I think. But others, even Harvard, every place that would get started would go someplace in the world and find a radio astronomer and say, we would like to do this too, or something.
Well, the opposite happened. I mean, Charlie Seeger started at Cornell and didn't get far and went to Leiden.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure why it was so slow going here. I custom or habit or something.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, buddy.
That ends the interview with George Seelstad on 22 May 1985.